This is a very tough day for Shell, a very tough day for Alaska.
It's a good day for the Arctic Ocean. It's really a shocking development.
Shell is abandoning its Arctic drilling program. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Bull Deer Island at the far end of the Aleutian Chain. It's a destination for seabirds and seabird researchers.
To describe it to my family, I just call it, you know, National Geographic Syndrome. You want to go to the wildest places and enjoy the show, and it's quite a show.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
After sinking 8 years and more than $8 billion into the effort, Shell Oil is pulling out of the Arctic Ocean. The company dropped the surprising news in a Sunday night press release. KUCB's John Ryan reports from Unalaska.
Shell officials said the company safely drilled a well more than a mile beneath the floor of the Chukchi Sea this summer. They found indications of oil and gas there, but not enough to warrant further exploration. Meg Baldino is a spokesperson for Shell Alaska.
We thought it was the potential to be a multi-billion barrel prospect. That is not the case. It's not commercial.
Oil prices have plummeted in the past year. A bonanza of fracking in the lower 48 has made costly oil from the Arctic Ocean less attractive as a global commodity. The announcement comes as Shell's window for drilling in the brief Arctic summer draws to a close. Baldino says about 400 people work in Anchorage on the Arctic drilling effort. Up to 3,000 Shell contractors are working in the field at any given time. Two drill rigs and much of the 30-vessel fleet are still in the Chukchi Sea.
The Burger J well will be sealed and abandoned, so we will begin demobilization immediately and head south. You know, everything has changed. So there's lots of details of what will happen next that are going to be worked out in the coming weeks.
It's really a shocking development.
Michael Levine is an attorney with the environmental group Oceana in Juneau.
It's a good day for the Arctic Ocean and lets us move past arguing about Shell and Shell's plans and its investment and move toward talking about the future of the Arctic Ocean.
Environmental groups had been pushing unsuccessfully for the Obama administration to block Arctic drilling. Instead, the administration gave Shell the green light. The Interior Department did require Shell to keep its rigs at least 15 miles apart if they were drilling at the same time. That was done to protect walruses in the area. Shell has spent $1.4 billion this year alone in the Arctic. The company cited high costs as well as regulatory uncertainty for its decision to quit the Arctic. Alaska's congressional delegation blamed Obama administration regulations for the sudden end of Arctic offshore drilling. Governor Bill Walker also faulted the regulations.
Typically, when you bring a rig, spend that much money, you'll drill multiple wells. And to be able just to drill the one, that was unfortunate. You're betting everything on that one particular well.
Shell has had problems it could not blame on regulators. In past years, its rigs have run aground, ship construction ran behind schedule, safety equipment was crushed like a beer can. This year, one of Shell's icebreakers was on its way out of Dutch Harbor when it tore a 3-foot hole in its hull.
It hit a rock.
Ship salvage expert Dan McGone supervised the temporary repair work in Dutch Harbor.
We would have got them squared away and on their way within a few days. The complication was that they were under contract to Shell, and so the level of scrutiny and Shell's bureaucracy turned it into this great big deal, you know.
Shell's bureaucracy?
Oh, yeah. It makes the government look like patty cakes, you know.
That ship went to a dry dock in Oregon for permanent repairs before returning to the Arctic. That cost Shell several weeks of its summer drilling season. The company expects to take a $4 billion hit on its balance sheet from shuttering the project. Any impacts on Alaska are probably more long-term than short-term. Any oil from Shell's Arctic venture would have taken about a decade before it wound up in a pipeline or anybody's gas tank. In Unalaska, I'm John Ryan.
Senator Lisa Murkowski says news that Shell is pulling out of the Alaskan Arctic hit her hard.
Heartsick, kick in the gut, just really devastated.
Murkowski says dry holes are a fact of oil exploration, but she blames the federal government for curtailing Shell.
You've got a very, very difficult federal regulatory environment that can chase that business away. And we saw that over the course of the past 7 years and $7 billion of commitment from Shell.
Murkowski, who as chairman of the Senate Energy Committee helped shape the nation's energy policy, named one government decision in particular as an impediment. The company intended to run two drilling rigs at the same time, 9 miles apart. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said no, citing a pre-existing rule requiring a 15-mile buffer between rigs to protect walrus. Murkowski says that was a big blow to Shell.
That wasn't part of what they had anticipated. That was a huge financial setback for them. Having that rig on standby.
Officials at the Interior Department said repeatedly they were holding Shell to rigorous standards to protect the environment. Shell's global priorities may have played a role in its decision, too. In April, Shell's CEO said the company aimed to pare down to three types of businesses, which did not seem to include the Chukchi project. Company executives labeled the Arctic a longer-term option, a category they slated for review and reduction. Senator Liesl McGuire, a Republican from Anchorage, likely surprised attendees at the Arctic Energy Summit in Fairbanks today when she announced she would not seek re-election next year. McGuire said she chose the summit as the place to make her announcement because the Arctic and energy issues are two of the great passions of her life. She said although being a senator for the past 15 years has been an honor, she will not seek re-election when her term ends in 2016.
But I'll remain the next year and a half to work on more issues in the Arctic and energy over the next year and a half. But I decided to announce it today because there has been speculation about me running again and other people jumping into the race. And I just wanted to make that announcement.
McGuire has served as the co-chair of the Alaska Arctic Policy Commission. She also chairs the Senate Rules Committee, as well as being a member of the Senate Resources and Judiciary Committees. A new working group in Anchorage is bringing city, state, and federal resources to combat human trafficking across Alaska. The Berkowitz administration is taking the lead on the issue, working with the state's Department of Labor to hold regular meetings among law enforcement, advocacy organizations, and state agencies. At today's meeting, officials attended from the FBI, several nonprofits, and government bodies, including Representative Gabrielle Ledoux, chair of the legislature's Judiciary Committee. Much of the session covered how, if at all, participants imagine this group differing from a task force brought together by the last mayor's administration. That effort led to a 2013 report on trafficking. Berkowitz says, in addition to sex trafficking, he wants this current working group to focus on labor trafficking and exploitation. Attendees agreed to meet again next month with prepared briefs on past efforts to combat trafficking, legal statutes for trying cases, and the resources available to survivors. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, European cruise ship passengers are an increasingly common sight in Nome.
We like the tundra, the flowers, and the animals. We saw ice bears and moose.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Imagine spending 3 months on a windy island at the tip of the Aleutian Chain. There's no internet, no cell phones, and not much company besides the millions of seabirds who flock to Bulldeer Island to build their nests. For some wildlife biologists, that setup is paradise, and they'll do just about anything for the chance to find out what life looks like from Bulldeer. Reporter Lauren Rosenthal traveled to the island to bring back this story.
It's the night before Ryan Mong is scheduled to start work. He crawls into the cargo hold of the research vessel Tekla and runs down his list of supplies.
All these white boxes are the food that we've ordered from a distributor, packed up things we really like. The srirachas, like the stuff that you just always have a lot of back home.
And can't get on Bulldeer Island. It's more than 300 miles west of Adak. Unlike other parts of the Aleutians, Boldir was too isolated to be used as a breeding ground for foxes. Without those predators, the seabird colony took off. Boldir is now the most diverse nesting spot in the entire Northern Hemisphere and a research station for the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge. It's also a legend among field biologists like Ryan Mong.
You know, it's like, oh, you get to ride a boat for 2 weeks out to the end of the Aleutian chain, and there's so many seabirds that they're going to hypnotize you. So I immediately got on the email, sent the resume off.
It took 3 years, but Mong finally won a job studying bird nests on Boldir with two other scientists. He knows it's not for everyone.
To describe it to my family, I just call it, you know, National Geographic syndrome. You want to go to the wildest places, the places with the most species, enjoy the show, and it's quite a show.
Once the ship pulls up to Boldir, Mong and his colleagues start moving hundreds of pounds of food and tools into an inflatable skiff. From there, they ferry each load onto the beach. The crew of the research vessel lends a hand, along with Jeff Williams, assistant manager of the Alaska Maritime Refuge. As he waits for more cargo, Williams points to a boulder resting on the shore.
Where that puffin just landed right there, you might find like four or five burrows around this rock, and storm petrel that's nesting in that grass tussock on top and puffins underneath and from different angles, and it's just, Swiss cheese just really describes it.
Finding the holes is the first step to doing research on Boldir. Every time Williams hires a new crew, he has them chart out a handful of nests from each species. Then the team hikes back over the course of the summer to see how many eggs hatch and what happens to the chicks. It's all part of a long-term project to pick out trends in bird populations. It also provides clues about possible changes in the oceans around Boldir. And it all starts here.
If you think about it, every one of these bird poops, there's millions of them. So it's like millions and millions of pounds of fertilizer coming onto this. So it creates this vegetation that's super dense and rank. I bring machetes and stuff for people to cut their way through the path.
Williams has run research stations all across the refuge. Boldir is the biggest, with a wooden cabin and weatherport tents. Still, Williams says,
you can be a camp leader or a worker at Boldir. You really earned your stripes.
The weather is bad, the days are long, and the pay is about $15 an hour. Williams says it takes a special kind of person to sign up, or a special kind of couple. Before Boldir Island, Mackenzie Mudge and Kevin Pietschuk met at a research site in Antarctica.
And so they hired me on, and I trained Mackenzie. And after that, we traveled together and had a good time.
When was that?
2008, 9?
9-10?
9-10?
Yeah,
9-10.
How do you keep all of it straight?
I don't.
It's not uncommon for scientists to fall in love out in the field. But for the most part, Mudge and Pietschuk have stayed there, studying birds from Chile all the way up to the North Slope.
It's different. It's kind of weird to go back down to Southern California and see my friends that have houses and families and kids of their own. And I'm like, well, I've got to see a lot of the world. That's really cool, right?
Eventually, they'd like to put down roots. But first, they wanted to experience Boldir. The boxes are all unloaded, and Ryan Mong is pulling on his hip waders, ready to push the skiff back out to sea one last time and get down to work.
You know, everybody always, like, says Boldir is a big life changer, but it's just, I don't know, you just feel lucky getting to do it. Because, you know, most people, they just get to come out once or so.
So this might be it?
Yeah, I like living like that.
Does it sound okay? Because I'm in a restaurant right now. I don't know if it's too loud.
It's been almost 3 months since I last talked to Ryan Mong, and a lot has changed. For one thing, he's not on an island anymore. Mong had to leave early after he accidentally cut his hand on a machete.
Luckily, the doctor told me there'd be no permanent damage and that I just need to start doing physical therapy.
Injury aside, Mong says the island was everything he hoped and more. Spending so much time working with a couple like Mudge and Pietschuk made him think.
Kind of hit me. Kind of need to go settle down with with my loved one and make her mine for the long run. So I decided out on Boldir that it's finally time to propose to my girlfriend and brought it up with her. Unfortunately, on the phone.
Mong followed up in person, bicycling across the west to the national park where his girlfriend works. When he got there, the answer was yes. Reporting on Boldir Island, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
As sea ice melts and temperatures rise, the Arctic is seeing an increase in vessel traffic. But it's not just icebreakers and research vessels making the journey up north. Cruise ships, mainly European ones, are also taking advantage of the region's more navigable waters. KNOM's Emily Russell spoke with some cruise ship passengers at a recent stopover in Nome and has this story.
They're hard to miss. Most of them wear matching red jackets. Many carry around identical ship-issued polyester backpacks, juxtaposed by their designer genuine leather rolling suitcases. They're usually only in town for a few hours, half a day at most, enough time to walk the length of Front Street, get bussed around the outskirts of town, and be back to the port by dinner time. Cruise ship passengers are an increasingly common sight during Nome summer, but unlike the tourists that flood the streets in March for the Iditarod, passengers aboard ships like the Bremen, a German cruise ship that passed through Nome earlier this month, a majority of them are European and know very little of what Nome has to offer. In fact, many only know the town for its role in the last great race.
I know Nome only from the Iditarod. This is the only thing I know from Nome.
Valtraud is from Nuremberg, Germany. It's her fourth time aboard the Bremen, but her first time in Nome. She says she and her husband like to travel to colder climates, visiting remote places like the Norwegian Arctic island of Spitsbergen to see polar bears. They've also sailed all the way down to Antarctica to see penguins. The Bremen will sail across the Bering Strait to the Russian port of Pravdenia, where the ship's itinerary suggests the passengers could see whales, seabirds, walruses, and seals. It will then sail down the Kamchatka Peninsula through the Kuril Islands and eventually dock at Japan's western coast after more than 3 weeks at sea. While Valtraud and over 100 other passengers are beginning their trip aboard the Bremen in Nome, many have reached Nome at the end of their journey and are crossing paths over lunch at Old St. Joe's.
We did by ship the northeastern passage from Tromsø to Nome, and it was just great. It was just great. We liked the tundra, the flowers, and the animals. We saw ice bears and moose and lots of fishes. It was great.
That's Susan, a Swiss passenger who was also not a first-timer aboard the Bremen, though it was her first time in Nome. So why are so many Europeans choosing to set sail through the Arctic?
I think it's a combination of, well, the fact that wealthy Europeans have been trying to do the Northwest Passage for about the last 600 years.
Andrew Mew is a vessel agent for Cruise Line Agencies of Alaska. He says that the emphasis of leave time and the value of travel in European society are other factors that account for the large number of European cruise ship passengers that come through Nome. But, as Mew suggests, recent activity in Alaska may lead to more visits by American tourists.
With President's visit up here, with America taking the chairmanship of the Arctic Council, there's just been more discussion of the Arctic, at least in the United States. And I would expect that that might produce a slight jump in U.S. passenger interest in the Arctic.
Next year might see more than just a slight jump in American passengers that come through Nome, as the English-speaking cruise ship the Crystal Serenity will make a call to port here next August on its way up to the Northwest Passage. While most of the cruise ships that come through Nome carry about 150 passengers, the Crystal Serenity will have over 1,000, nearly tripling the number of Nome is used to hosting in the summer. While it might be the first passenger ship of its size to traverse the once-fabled and elusive Northwest Passage, the Crystal Serenity is just another sign that tourism is both expanding and diversifying in response to the rapidly melting Arctic. Reporting from Nome, I'm Emily Russell.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation announced last week it will spend about $4 million to clean up a former Wrangell junkyard site with high levels of lead contamination. Wrangell Economic Development Director Carol Rushmore says Wrangell initially got a grant from the Environmental Protection Agency to test for contamination at the former site of the Byford junkyard, which is about 4 miles south of town.
The assessment came in and said we had very high levels of lead
contamination, and EPA jumped on it, was trying to get some funds, and then the accident in Colorado happened, and those funds were diverted, and we were told it wasn't going to happen.
The accident Rushmore is referring to was when the EPA released waste from the Gold King mine into a river in Colorado this summer. When federal funds were needed to clean up that mine waste, the state of Alaska took on the Wrangell junkyard cleanup. According to a DEC memo, the lead level at the former junkyard site is so high that it warrants an emergency cleanup. People living near the site could be affected by the high levels of lead in the ground. The EPA was planning to monitor lead levels in the blood of workers performing the cleanup due to the severity of the contamination. The site was used as a junkyard for a few decades, where people dumped cars, batteries, oil, and scrap metal. No effort was made to properly store those items. The city and borough of Wrangell inherited the junkyard through a property tax foreclosure and cleared debris from the property, but it didn't have the resources to excavate contaminated soil. It's been a dry summer for Kodiak, which has lowered bodies of water throughout Kodiak Island, including the Menashka Reservoir, an important water source for residents. And the island hasn't seen the rain that has doused much of South Central Alaska in September. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has more.
According to Rick Toman, the climate science and services manager for the Alaska region of the National Weather Service, it's one of the driest seasons in Kodiak history.
Kodiak, since June 1st, has received just over 10 inches of rain. That's just about half of normal for that time and is the second lowest of record. The only reliable warm kind of time of year was back in 1941. When there was less than 8 inches of rain from June through September.
Kodiak City Public Works Director Mark Kozak says the lack of snowfall last winter has also contributed to the lowered reservoir. Kozak says both the community at large and its seafood processors rely on the Menashka Reservoir as a water source.
When the processors aren't using water, our daily consumption is about 2 million gallons a day. But when they're processing here prior to the middle of last week, as a community, we were averaging between 7.7 and 8.3 million gallons a day.
He says at a meeting Friday, the processors agreed to limit their water usage where they can.
They'll do all the careful monitoring of excess water usage and turn things off and that. And what we really want to be able to do is support the processing industry so that, you know, everybody's still working and the fishermen are working, the process workers. And so by conserving, we can allow them to continue to operate as long as we're able.
Kozak says the pollock season opens on October 1st and processors are in transition at this point, which also affects the water use. He says they'll have a better idea of what changes processors have been able to make by the end of the week when they reach full production. In Kodiak, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
The environmental impact statement for the proposed Donlin gold mine is expected to be released in late November. Once it's published, it will start a new phase. If built, the mine will be among the largest in the world. KYUK's Lakeed Rashavis has the story.
Permitting for the proposed Donlin gold mine, which will affect communities along the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, is underway. An official draft of the statement examining the mine's effects on the environment will be available at the end of November. But before the mine can be built, more than 150 permits and certifications must be approved by federal, state, and local agencies. Approval from state agencies is ongoing, but in order to get federal approvals, an Environmental Impact Statement, or EIS, is required. Kurt Parkin is the External Affairs Manager for Donlin Gold.
In July of 2012, Donlin Gold submitted its initial application to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for a Clean Water Act 404 permit.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is the lead organization producing the EIS. The Corps of Engineers is a federal agency that handles public engineering and managing services. In some cases, an environmental assessment is completed to determine if an EIS should be conducted. But Keith Gordon, the project manager for the Corps of Engineers Division in Alaska, says there was no question that an EIS was needed for the gold mine.
Well, the reality is, for the scale of some projects and the potential impacts of some projects, it's obvious immediately that an environmental impact statement is necessary.
Gordon says the draft of the EIS should be available to the public November 30th. People will have a chance to comment in person, online, and by writing letters from the time the EIS is published until next April.
We're currently evaluating 14 public meetings that would be conducted to facilitate comment from 66 potentially affected communities in the region.
By impacted communities, Gordon means areas that will be affected in employment or socioeconomically. Gordon says the EIS will be over 1,000 pages long, but only the executive summary will be translated into Yupik. In English, the summary is estimated to be 120 pages, but Gordon says the Yupik translation will be about half as long, at 60 pages.
Given all the meetings that have been held up and down the Kuskokwim River, they're thinking that that will adequately define the project for those folks that need to see it in Yupik or prefer to see it in Yupik.
The proposed mine is a joint venture between two Canadian companies, Bear Gold Corporation and Nova Gold, as well as the Calista Corporation and the Kuskokwim Corporation. The native corporations own the surface and subsurface rights. Bear Gold has subcontracted AECOM, an international multi-management service, to handle the Yupik translation. Gordon says that once the public comment period is over, the Corps of Engineers will review the statements and reassess or improve the mining plan, if necessary. He says the Corps of Engineers hopes to make a final decision by December 2017. But Gordon says predicting when this process will be over is kind of like predicting the weather. In Bethel, I'm Lakita Chavis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from John Ryan in Unalaska, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Lauren Rosenthal on Bull Deer Island, Emily Russell in Nome, Katerina Sestarik in Wrangell, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, and Lakedra Chavis in Bethel. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Rural CAP commemorates 50 years of delivering early childhood education programs like Head Start and Parents as Teachers. Signature housing programs, including weatherization, self-help housing, and permanent affordable housing, make a difference in our communities. AmeriCorps members and elder mentors have positive impacts to education, health, and the environment. Learn more at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.